Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second?
Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue. And the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
Shout out to our show sponsors, Mint Inc. Mint stands for the Minority Interdisciplinary Networking Team. Mint empowers young minority professionals with an interdisciplinary network for learning, collaboration, and the development of entrepreneurial ventures. Follow them on Instagram at Mint Inc. _USA and look out for the next issue of Mint Mag.
So you want to start a podcast, huh? Well, we got something to help you. The Black Real Estate Dialogue brings you the How to Start a Successful Podcast on a Budget with No Experience ebook and webinar bundle.
We are controlling transmission.
Come and put info into action as we show you the step-by-step process to sharing your successful podcast on a budget. This bundle is full of the exact details, social media hacks, and podcasting process we've used to gain 13,000 downloads and over 10,000 Instagram followers. But that's not all. As a bonus, you'll receive the exact super trackers we use to stay organized and free access to our private Facebook group designed to help you execute. Make sure you click that link now because there is an audience for you to reach. The How to Start a Successful Podcast on a Budget with No Experience, the ebook and webinar bundle presented by the Black Real Estate Dialogue.
Do you really think investing in real estate is too expensive?
Well, you wrong about that.
Presenting a beginner's guide to buying your first out-of-state property, a Black Real Estate Dialogue course. That's right, it's the new course presented by the Black Real Estate Dialogue, teaching you how to develop the investor's mindset, the advantages of investing out of state, getting your finances in order, finding the right location, assembling your team, creating financing strategies, how to find and analyze properties, how to find tenants, real-life case studies, and so much more in bonus content.
Oh yeah, did we mention you have lifetime access?
My goodness! If you have dreams of buying a property out of state but have no idea where to start, well, this is the guide for you. Learn the tips from someone with firsthand experience. Are you looking for a community of like-minded individuals and access to experts in real estate?
Yeah.
Are you interested in real estate but need more support and guidance?
You know who it is.
The Black Real Estate Dialogue presents the Real Estate Investing Community. No matter how much or how little real estate experience you have, we've created a community for you because your perspective is important. All right, tell me, what's the number one place where you can do Q&A with experienced guest speakers 3 times a month? How about unlimited access to past guest speakers' recordings? What about a private Slack channel to engage in daily discussion with everybody in the community to share resources and support each other? Head on over to gumroad.com/bread. That's gumroad.com/BRED. It's the Real Estate Investing Community presented by the Black Real Estate Dialogue. Come join us today.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 59. A couple quick announcements before we get into this week's episode. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, and leave a comment on whichever platform you're listening to this on. It'll help us move up in the rankings and it'll help us reach more people. So thank you in advance for helping us in that way. If you'd like to get the latest updates on what's happening at the Black Real Estate Dialogue, text BRED to 21,000 to join our free VIP text list. Also, if you want to gain early access to episodes, bonus content, discounts on merch, and more, join our Patreon program. Visit patreon.com/Black Real Estate Dialogue to join or visit the link in the show notes. Shout out to this episode's sponsor, Buy Back the Block LA. The mission of Buy Back the Block LA is to educate our community on the value of practicing group economics and building generational wealth. They focus on real estate as the main tool to building generational wealth and will take you from beginner to investor by educating you on the ins and outs of investing and giving you the tools you need to empower your family and your community. Every month, they hold a meetup educating the community on real estate investing, financial literacy, generational wealth, and group economics. Their new ebook, Section 8 Rentals Made Easy, is in the show notes below, so definitely check that out. You can also visit them on Instagram at buybacktheblockla and at buybacktheblockla.com. Something I'm excited to share is that starting this episode, we'll have 2 new segments of the show. One is the real estate definition of the day, and the second is an inspirational quote from a Black entrepreneur or pioneer. So definitely excited to provide more value. So definitely make sure you listen through the whole episode. They'll be placed throughout the episode. So I'm very excited about that. We also have our website dropping very, very soon. So you'll be able to find everything, all the information, all the resources in one place. So definitely look out for more information about that. This episode was legendary. I'm super excited about it. I know you'll get a whole lot of value out of it. So without further ado, let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. I'm very excited for this episode. It's about to be a great episode. Here with me, I have Chris Senegal out of Houston, Texas. Chris, thanks for coming on the show, man.
No problem, man. I'm glad to be here. Glad to be here, bro.
Definitely. So I would love to hear from you just to start off what your childhood was like and what you saw or maybe what you didn't see that ultimately shaped your view of building wealth.
You know what? So my childhood was cool. I mean, both of my parents had good, stable income. They were divorced. I lived in two different cities. One lived in Lake Charles, Louisiana. My dad and my mom lived in Port Arthur, Texas. I can't really say that anything in my childhood really sparked the wealth generation drive or the entrepreneurship mission. I created my own challenges, right? So I got kicked out of middle school for making dumb decisions, like bringing alcohol to school. And then in high school, I got my girlfriend pregnant. So I was a teenage father. I was a dad at 16, but I still went to college on full academic scholarship, got out, got that great corporate job as an engineer. Cause you know, everybody said be a doctor, lawyer, engineer, right? So I was like, I'm gonna be smart and I'm gonna go engineer cause it takes the least amount of time. Did that, got in the work world and realized I don't like this corporate environment. I can't do this for the next 40 years. So that was really what was the catalyst for me to say, I got to hit reset and figure out what I'm going to do in my life because I can't just work for somebody else for the next 40, 50 years. So
Definitely. So what was that transition like when you realized at that point, you know, this is not for me? Like what came next for you?
Man, reading a whole lot of books, just like putting myself almost in isolation and like losing friends, losing a girlfriend who thought I was money hungry. And I was just like, no, it's not that I'm money hungry. I just want to get money out of the way. Like I want to figure out how to make money work for me instead of me having to make myself completely uncomfortable every day to go to work to earn income and let somebody else tell me how many days I can be sick, how much vacation I can take, what time I have to wake up every morning, when I have to take my lunch break. You know, just for me, that was just like, that was the norm for society. But for me, I was like, this is not going to work. So it was, I had to hit a lot of reset, you know, so that was it. It was uncomfortable, but you know, eventually all of my friends and my former classmates that told me I was crazy are now in a position where they're asking me to help them do the same thing, you know, so.
Definitely. So what did the early days of real estate look like for you?
Early days. So I started flipping houses in 2008. I was 2 years out of school. I literally took everything that was in my 401k at that time, between what I put in and what my company had matched, which was like $11,000, $12,000. And I took that money, I borrowed against it, and I used that as the down payment to get a hard money loan to do my first flip. And I had worked with a contractor who worked for one of the biggest flipping companies or wholesaling companies. It's a company called Homevestors, the We Buy Ugly Houses people. So I was able to get a connection with their main contractor and he kind of became my mentor. And so we picked a house from there, I just kept going, you know, renovating and flipping houses, selling some, keeping some as rentals.
Definitely. And one thing you mentioned that I like there is, you know, you had a small sum of money, but mm-hmm. you were able to use it to, you know, put a down payment on that flip and kind of, you know, snowball from there. So I don't want people to despise small beginnings, right? You know, because you started with $6,000, really.
Yeah. My $6,000 matched with my company's match, which made it like $11,000. Mm-hmm. And then I just borrowed against that, you know. And I was like, for me, it's like, do I want to wait 40 years to be able to touch this money? Or do I want to take it out and use it now and try to put me in a better position for life? And so that was just a risk I took because we're kind of conditioned when you go to the corporate world to be very conservative and, you know, leave that 401k, don't touch that because that's where you're going to have that $1 million when you're 65. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, I want $1 million in the next few years. I don't want that.
Definitely. So about how long were you kind of flipping and landlording before you started the crowdfund?
So I did fix and flip and landlording from 2008 to 2013. And that's when I was fed up with it, like 5 years of doing that. And it's like, you know, and then like you see on HGTV, there's a lot more expense tied to the flips, a lot more stress tied to the flips, dealing with individual tenants that damage property and all that kind of stuff. You know, now I'm not knocking anybody that does that because, you know, you can make money in any endeavor, you know, but for me, it just wasn't the right fit for me. So that's when I hit reset and I decided I was going to start going after bigger projects where I could buy contiguous parcels, where I could own several pieces of real estate in one location at the same time. So that's how I got started with my new model.
Definitely. So can you talk to us about so one thing that's also interesting is that you reset a couple of times up to this point. You know, you kind of did what you had to do for the moment. So whether it's like 9 to 5, whether it was the flipping and landlording, until it was time to move to the next thing. And, you know, I think that's a big key right there. You know, just not being afraid to kind of reinvent yourself and transition and move on to the next phase of life, to the next phase of investing.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes is, you know, be steadfast in your goals, but be flexible in your approach. Because, I mean, that's just the key. There's no way you can sit down and write out a plan and for it really to come to fruition exactly as you write it out. It's just impossible. So your only goal is to put energy out there, do things, and treat the failures as feedback on what you need to adjust, right, and what you need to change. So, you know, I'm in Houston. It's a lot harder to get a lot of good deals to flip in Houston because it's so competitive. Other markets, it's easy to get good deals. I know guys in Jersey making 100 grand per flip like all day. I'm just not in that market. So for me, I have to adjust my plan. I can't stick with what I thought in my head was going to work. I have to adjust to my market and make the best decisions for me that's going to get me to the next level, right? So yeah, that's really been my approach. I have shifted several times. Fix and flip was cool. Rental properties was cool. But for me, in like 2013, I said, well, what if I can control an entire block? Like, what happens if I buy this whole block and I decide to do something with it? And what if it takes me even 3 or 4 years to get that project done? And let me look at the numbers and look at the profit. And let me compare that to if I'm flipping maybe one house every 2 or 3 months. And let me see what those numbers look like. And so what it equated to was me waiting those 3 years to do a bigger project yielded me a bigger return and with less stress. So that's when I really decided to make that pivot.
Definitely. So can you talk about just that first time, like, you know, going from the idea to action? So the idea of, you know, if I can control the whole block, to when you actually were able to do it and how it all worked?
Yeah, so it all kind of happened really quickly in the first year. And what I realized is the same principles that wholesalers use to find distressed owners. There's distressed portfolio owners, just like there's distressed individual property owners. And some of them own their houses free and clear because like they or their portfolios free and clear because, you know, they've been in the industry that long. So for me, it became targeting real estate portfolio owners that have no debt on the property. So either they've paid off the mortgage because they've owned it so long or they've inherited it. And that second generation, man, they fumble the ball a whole lot when it comes to real estate. And so that's why I always correct people when they say real estate is generational wealth. It's really not. It's financial freedom for you unless you have put the right systems and the right management in place so that whether your kids want to actively be landlords or not, you know, then that those assets are still performing for them. And most of the time it doesn't happen. Every big acquisition I've made through creative financing, which is seller finance, owner financing, has either been a landlord who's a tired landlord and the kids don't want to deal with what they saw their parents go through, or it's somebody that's already inherited the property and haven't been taken care of it, you know? So yeah, that was my transition. Finding those folks, the first one I found actually was a Jewish guy whose father owned 26 blocks in Fifth Ward, which is an all-Black neighborhood. And this guy had inherited this block. And I was able to sit down with him and talk to him. And he's like, I want $500,000. And this is when they were calling this neighborhood the Bloody Nickel. It was Fifth Ward. They called it the Bloody Nickel. But I'm like, okay, that's a little bit high. But hey, you're right on the main freeway from the International Airport. I can see downtown. I can throw a rock at the Astro Stadium. I was like, I'm willing to play ball. So negotiate an owner finance deal with him, give him 10% down, start making payments to him. And that's how I was able to contiguously own a whole block in 2013. So, you know, 2018, when buy the block started becoming trendy, I was like, okay, I've been doing this. It's cool that other people catching on, you know? So, but yeah, man, so that was my transition. You know, and I always buy things that already have some type of revenue already coming from. So this block, it already had some of the houses were leased out. It had an old grocery store that was leased out, but you know, It was sketchy. But I converted over to parolee housing for the first few years because I could rent the rooms out individually, which generated a lot more revenue while I figured out the development play that I wanted to do with the property. So
definitely. So one thing that I'm picking up already is that you're a very creative guy. So
yeah, man, for sure.
Definitely. So like each part of the story thus far, you use some creativity, some outside of the box thinking to get things done. So I think,
yeah,
I think
because when you look at any institutional process, it wasn't created for us to be successful. It's really created for the successful to be successful. And it's hard for you to get into that circle. And like the property I'm talking about, if I went to a bank and said, hey, I'm making $80,000 a year and I have good credit and there's no new construction in this neighborhood, there's no flips in this zip code, will you give me $500,000? They would have said, hell no. You know, they would have shut me down. Matter of fact, like 23 different lenders actually did shut me down when I was trying to do my new construction on that same block. But, you know, when you find other ways to take control of the property, like I'm saying, seller financing is the key for me. You know, you don't have to wait for anybody else's outside approval. You don't have to wait for anybody else to say you're bankable or you're financeable. You know, you just go with your own motion and you make calculated bets based off of studying real estate trends in your market and understanding that it will come. And you will be ahead of the curve by controlling it before it comes.
Definitely. So you mentioned that, you know, after owning that area, those blocks for a while, that you started new construction. So can you talk mm-hmm. to us more about that? Was that like always the idea, or was it something that kind of came along? Like, you know what, I think I could develop on this land.
Yeah. So I bought the property in 2013. And like I said, I was watching the development trends in the city and I knew that it was eventually going to hit this neighborhood. I just didn't know when. So it was a calculated risk, a calculated investment. I bought in 2013. In 2016, the biggest developer in Houston bought 150 acres on the south end of the same neighborhood and announced they were going to do this big mixed use development. So for me, at that point, I was like, okay, now the bet has paid off. Now what am I going to do? And, you know, gentrification is something huge that happens in our communities. And for me, it was like, okay, what can I do to counter the narrative of what usually happens? And so for me, the first thing I thought of was, well, number one, we as the successful Black community always miss the value appreciation waves that happen when our neighborhoods get gentrified. Because we're out in the suburbs and we're mad because somebody's renovating the neighborhood we grew up in. No, it needs to be the opposite. It needs to be, once we find out they're renovating or revitalizing or redeveloping, we need to be in lockstep on the side of them controlling as much of the real estate around there as possible. And one way for me to make that happen was to tear down this old grocery store that was at the end of its useful life. I couldn't get a grocery store to come back, to take that parolee program and move it to another site and take this entire block and build new construction and target young Black working professionals who are in the suburbs. Most of them don't have kids yet, so they're not worried about school systems, but they're in the suburbs with a house that's gonna appreciate 2-3% a year, and put them right in the heart of redevelopment where their house value and their land value is gonna double in the next 5 years. So that was my model, and that's what I decided to do with that property. And it's been working so far. You know, I've built and sold 5 of them. I've increased the value. I set my own comparable sales because there was no new construction in the zip code. First one sold for $279. Within the same year, by the time I sold the last one, I sold it for $298. So my first buyer already has almost $20,000 in equity in her house. And I'm waiting for the next phase to come out of permitting right now. Hopefully next couple of weeks, I'm building another 9. And so those will start at right at 300, which is still affordable for the young working professional and you know, with interest rates where they are. And yeah, everybody that owns a house, I know for sure they're gonna have $150,000 worth of equity in their home in a couple of years. Once that, it's a $2.4 billion development that's gonna be like literally less than a mile away from my development site. So everybody that owns that real estate over there is gonna have tremendous value appreciation.
Wow, That's incredible, man. That's incredible. Today's real estate definition of the week is cash flow. So cash flow is the amount of money you can pocket at the end of each month after all operating expenses, including loan payments, have been paid. If you spend less money than you earn, your cash flow will be positive. If you spend more money than you earn, your cash flow will be negative. So again, that's the rental income minus all operating expenses. That equals your cash flow. So what's that process like, just doing like the ground up development, new construction and so forth? What was that like early on, like when you were just starting to get into it, and how has it evolved since then?
You know, the process, it's a difficult process, because when you think about every other area of real estate, you are taking control of something that's already in existence, right? But the developer is the one that really comes up with the vision and takes something that does not exist and makes it a reality. And so it's a lot to that process. It's the longest process of all real estate careers or real estate professions, because, you know, there's a long permit process, there's a long approval process, then you have a build process, and then you have a sale process. So that could be 2 or 3 years easily, where you can flip a house in 3 months, you know, or 2 months from the time you buy it, flip it, get a contract on it, and go to closing 30 days later. That can happen in 3 months. With new development, 2 to 3 years. So big difference. So for me, it was identifying people that had actually done it that could kind of guide me. I spent about a year trying to figure it out, and I realized I'm just going to keep going with my head. There's too many nuances to it. So I eventually found a developer, black builder, that built like 300 houses a year, mainly for community development corporations and stuff like that. So I was able to garner his attention, and, you know, he became a consultant for me. He didn't do it for free, of course. He wanted me, I paid him $10,000 to consult with me on how to put the project together. And the agreement was, if the project actually got funded, he would credit the $10,000 against the construction costs, and he would be the builder. So that's what we did, and that's how it worked out. That's how I got started.
Got it. That's awesome. That's awesome, man. I think it's significant. You know, something that you mentioned just a few minutes ago is just that, you know, you saw this big developer in Houston come in, and you saw what was happening very close by, and you instantly thought, you know, we need to be a part of this, you know. And I think your whole plan is great, because, you know, not only are you building up the community, but you're getting professionals, black professionals, who were out in the suburbs somewhere, to come back to the community. And I think in that regard, everybody benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's what it has to be. Like I said, in these neighborhoods that we often don't like to see anything happen to, we want to kind of preserve the low income families that are there. And we want to do low income housing to protect them. We often forget that those used to be thriving neighborhoods, like before desegregation. The doctors, the lawyers, the business owners that own the movie theater, the grocery store, the cleaners, everything, all lived in this same community. But now we want to focus on it being low income, and that they really shouldn't be that way. We need the engineers, the doctors, the lawyers, the business owners, entrepreneurs back in that community, all participating, all being a part of that community. That's the only way you're going to get grocery stores back. That's the only way you're going to get any type of business back. Nothing will be supported with an entire community that's a low income demographic. You need people with disposable income for all that stuff to be revitalized. And so that's been my focus. And what better way to do that than to do it in a neighborhood that's already got a big catalyst for economic development by some big development that's coming that we don't have control over, you know? So the least we can do is participate and have the value appreciation that goes around it. Like, you know, usually the neighborhood's still too rough for us. We're still concerned about the crime rate. Meanwhile, somebody else is walking their dog and riding their bike, right? Yeah. And the people that are walking their dogs and riding their bikes are getting $100,000, $200,000 in value appreciation in their home, which directly correlates to their net worth. So when we talk about the net worth of the average black household being $17,000 and possibly going to zero by, they said, 2055, the way to reverse that trend is for more of us to buy in our own neighborhoods that are being redeveloped instead of letting gentrification happen. Imagine the family the young couple that's saying, well, I'm gonna move to the suburbs right now because when I have kids, I want my kids to be in a good school district. Imagine if that same couple bought in this neighborhood and had $300,000 in equity in their home by the time their kids were 18, and they could pay for their kids to go to whatever school they wanted to go to out of the equity in the home. Completely different ballgame, right? So we just have to start thinking differently about a lot of these things.
Definitely, definitely. So can you talk more about the real estate crowdfund? And you know, that was a pretty successful venture. I don't think we've had a guest who's done something at that scale. So can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So like I said, outside of the new construction where I'm bringing higher incomes back in, I always want to make sure I offset that with making sure that I protect the bleed rate, or the rate of people that are getting pushed out of these communities. So the only way that you can protect existing residents that are tenants is to own the real estate. You can ask the government to do, rent caps and all this other kind of stuff. But, you know, as politicians change, those laws change. So the only way you really can control the rents is to own the real estate. So one of my initiatives was buying rental portfolios. So I was able to buy a rental portfolio with seller financing, like I told you about earlier. But some of the tenants had been there like 20 years, long-term stable tenants. And the portfolio is 18 houses, and it came with two commercial buildings as well, but the commercial buildings were vacant. And this is literally even closer to the development project. It's like 0.6 miles away from the development project. So it's a street farther. It's a street closer to it from where my new construction is. So, okay, this is another good play to make. Buy this rental portfolio. Let all the tenants know they will not be displaced. We're going to keep their rents the same. And I'm going to make my return on the investment greater by bringing the two commercial buildings back to life, right? So the sellers of that property, like I said, own the property free and clear. It had been passed down to them. And I was able to negotiate seller financing with them with 50% down. And it was a $1.2 million acquisition. So I had to bring like $600,000 to the table for closing. And but then I also negotiated a payoff in 2 years for the other half, but no loan payments in between. So pay half now, pay half in 2 years. So with that, I was able to say, hey, it's generating over $10,000 a month right now in rents. So this is a great opportunity for me to do a crowdfund because I can let everybody collectively invest with me instead of me going to one or two wealthy individuals as private lenders. I wanted to create a new blueprint and say, hey, we don't have to wait for LeBron or Oprah or be mad at Denzel because he's not buying up the hood. We can collectively do these things on our own. So that was the model, and it worked. I started the crowdfund in like November 2019, and by the summer of 2020, I had maxed out what the SEC regulation was $1,070,000. So that gave me enough to replenish the cost of the acquisition and put money into renovating the commercial buildings to bring them back online. So I've turned the property around. I mean, we've done a lot of aesthetic upgrades, like repaving, like landscaping, painting, doing deferred maintenance repairs on the inside of the houses, like toilets, floorboards, kitchens, plumbing, all that kind of stuff. And then really focusing on generating a lot of revenue off of the vacant commercial and bringing those back online. So it's worked really well. I was able to actually pay out distributions to investors already at the end of last year. It's created a new blueprint for what's possible in our communities.
Today's inspirational quote is from the legendary Cicely Tyson, rest in peace. Challenges make you discover things about yourself that you never really knew. Much respect to Cicely Tyson. She lived a long and full life. She worked doing what she loved until her very last day. So much respect to her. And I just hope you all are inspired by this quote. Don't be afraid of challenges that come in life, challenges that come in your real estate journey. You know, perhaps you want to invest, you're running into some roadblocks. Just know that if you persist, if you continue, if you don't give up, that eventually you'll be able to reach your goals of investing and your goals in life.
Definitely. Man, that sounds like a whole lot of work that paid off. Like, how did it feel? Just like when you reached the goal, when you capped out, and then also when you were able to make that first distribution, what did that feel like? What was going through your head during those times?
It's a sense of accomplishment, but it's just one of those things where it's like you're so focused on making it successful and you got so much weight on your shoulders to get it done that when it finally happens, it's almost like you're past the euphoria of celebration. You're just like happy that it happened. And you're like, okay, now let's keep going. That's really how it's been for me. But you know, like this project has gotten a lot of attention. It's been on the front page of the Houston Chronicle. It's been on the front of the business section of the Chronicle. It's been on the front of the real estate section of the Chronicle. So, you know, it's setting a blueprint and a real example for what can be done all over the country. So that's, When I start seeing it being replicated, I think I'll be more excited than just what I was able to accomplish on my own, you know.
Definitely. That's big. I mean, I've seen nothing like that in my lifetime. I definitely think, you know, it shows what we can do together. It shows how much, right. I mean, you raised over $1 million. I mean, I think it shows what's possible when we come together, when we pool our resources together you know, it can work.
Right. Yeah. And so the SEC just changed that requirement. I mean, that max. So now it's 5 million. So the next one, I'm going to try to see if I can get it close to 5 million as possible and do bigger projects, and maybe take that 5 million and divide it up and do a few projects all at once, you know? So that's the goal.
Definitely. Definitely. And you had a recent acquisition, a department store and pawn shop, I believe, pretty recently that you
acquired. Oh, yeah. So I've had two recent acquisitions. So that one. Yeah. So the department store was two entrepreneurs that own the most popular gym in another historically Black and Jewish neighborhood in Houston called Third Ward. And, you know, they're right on the main corridor where all the redevelopment is happening. And they needed someone to come in and invest with them to expand the gym because they were basically buckling at the seams. They had so many members that members were leaving because the gym was too crowded. And we had COVID, so nobody really wanted to be in there in a crowd. So I we had a meeting and they were like, well, you know, can you invest? And for me, I was like, well, I don't know anything about the gym business. I like to invest in what I know. I was like, so if you can find a building that I can buy, then I'll be willing to partner with you. And they were like, well, actually the building next door that we're trying to expand into, they offered a seller financing. And we told them, no, we didn't think we needed that. So I was like, no, I will definitely do that deal. So if it's the same model that I was doing in Fifth Ward, you know, owner finance the property. And you know, then I had an investor come in and help out. Actually my broker, my real estate broker, Jay Bradley, came in and invested some money to front the cost for the repairs. I put up the money for the acquisition. And yeah, so now that renovation is complete. The gym has expanded into that facility now. Membership is already growing. And this building that we bought was like a historic building in Third Ward. It was the department store that everybody grew up going to. It was also a pawn shop. But everybody from Richard Pryor, Aretha Franklin, when they would come to Houston, that's where they would shop. That's where you buy your fur coats. That's where you would buy your Rolex watches and all that kind of stuff. Wow. And so, you know, my tagline is, you know, we took a historic landmark where people used to blow wealth. And now we've converted to something where everybody can focus on their health, you know, which is reality. And we own it now. Before we didn't own it, it was somebody else that owned it, you know, outside of the community. So, yeah, it's just a great storyline. And then the other acquisition I just made was back in Fifth Ward. It's a historic landmark. There was a church that was right at the intersection of the two major freeways in Houston, right across from the Astro Stadium, right across the freeway from Astro Stadium. And so it's a 5-acre parcel. And, you know, I closed on that in December. We're going to do a big opportunity zone mixed use project on that, where it's going to be some commercial and about 270 apartment units. So
definitely exciting stuff, man. Exciting stuff. So, you know, earlier you mentioned that you would love to see something like this replicated across the country. So what advice do you have to someone who has that zeal and, you know, they kind of want to explore doing this, you know, either on a similar scale or maybe even on a smaller scale? What advice would you give to somebody? What should they be thinking about as they explore trying to do things similar to what you did?
Yeah, so number one, I would say get your own experience first. Make sure you have done enough projects to where you're completely comfortable and confident that you can execute a bigger scale project successfully. Because, you know, it's a huge difference from risking your own money and then going publicly and being in the public spotlight and taking a whole bunch of people's money. You know, you don't want to get in that position and not be able to perform and get people. Number one, people want to know a few things when they invest, right? They want to know, am I going to get my money back? Am I going to get it back on time? And am I going to get it back with a profit, right? So if you aren't confident that you can answer those three questions well, it's not time for you to get into raising outside capital for projects. And number two, I would say, like what I said earlier, is I would suggest that you find something that already has some type of revenue coming from it. Don't use crowdfunding for ground up development, or don't use crowdfunding for renovating something that's going to take a long time, that's completely vacant and has no income coming in, because you need to make sure you have a basis to pay the investors back the distributions or dividends along the way. Unless you have really overly communicated, there will be no money coming back out for a couple of years. If you know, that will take a lot more exposure, because a lot more investors will not be interested in that, but it's possible to still do a project that way. And I would say most importantly is having the team around you that can execute every component of the project, from the realtors to the property managers, to the architects, to the contractors, to the CPAs. You need that entire team around you to execute it effectively.
Definitely. And when it comes to like building your team, I mean, you have a whole lot going on, right? So how what have you learned along the way as far as like building your team the right way in a way that can continue to make sure you're able to get stuff done? Because, you know, obviously you got a whole lot going on.
So, yeah. So I would say the biggest thing is leveraging subject matter experts with proven track records. While you may meet a bunch of people that have the exact same mindset as you and the same aggressive posture and the same attitude of wanting to conquer the world, if they have not actually done what you're trying to do, you know, you're all going to be in the same boat trying to figure it out and bumping your head and not knowing what to adjust to get it right. So make sure you surround yourself with people that have actually done it, that have already accomplished it. And then you have plenty of time to go back and work with the people that, you know, just have passion and want to learn. But, you know, to get yourself in the game and to set a blueprint and show that you have the capacity to execute, you need that team of experts all around you.
Definitely. What's your outlook on the Houston market? It seems like there's, from what you shared, there's like been a whole lot happening, a lot of different development over the years.
Oh yeah, man. Houston is steadily growing. I mean, 100,000 people a year, something like that, steadily coming to Houston. So the demand for housing cannot keep up with the expansion and the growth of the city. So it's always going to be a booming market. And a lot of people think Houston is all oil and gas, but we have silver industries. The biggest or the equivalent size of oil and gas is the medical industry because of the medical center here has the MD Anderson, one of the best treatment centers in the U.S. next to Johns Hopkins. It might be about the same. So, you know, when everybody else was struggling during COVID, Houston was booming because of all the medical. And, you know, whether you're in real estate rentals or you're in real estate short-term, like Airbnb type rentals, everybody's doing very, very well right now. And the market is steadily growing. You also have a lot of recidivism out of the expensive markets like California and New York, where a lot of people are coming to Houston or going to, or they're coming to Texas or they're going to Florida. So yeah, you see a lot of that going on right now where they can sell their houses out there and pay cash for houses three times the size here. And so, you know, the real estate market is really resilient. Even during 2008, we didn't have the inflation, so we didn't have the big bubble burst that a lot of other markets had. So, yeah, I'm very bullish on Houston as far as real estate.
Definitely. Have you considered any opportunities outside of Houston or outside of Texas?
So I do own real estate in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where I'm going to focus on kind of doing a similar project, but more focused around student housing because it's right by Southern University. Mm-hmm. I want to kind of create that model. I'll kind of take the model out of the historically Black neighborhoods and introduce it to the neighborhoods around HBCUs, you know, and kind of make show them that, you know, we can improve the communities around our campuses and maybe even have the universities participate so that they're not really tied to solely to being dependent on tuition to thrive. So, yeah, that's my next phase. I'm looking at projects in Chicago and Atlanta as well, because those are two really hot markets that have a lot of demand. So, yeah.
A lot coming in the future.
Oh, yeah, definitely, man. Definitely.
Awesome. So, you know, this has been a really inspirational interview, man. I think just thinking about where you started, right? You started at the 9-to-5 and you're like, you know, I'm just not feeling this. You know, there's got to be something else. To, you know, get into the flipping, get into the landlording for a period of time. You're like, this is cool, ready for the next thing. And then, you know, getting into buying the blocks, crowdfunding, new construction. And so I think, you know, one of the biggest lessons here is just creativity, thinking outside mm-hmm. the box, and not being afraid to adjust, not being afraid to reinvent yourself and take calculated risks. You mentioned yep. that several times, like calculated risks, like just
that's it.
Doing the best you can to hedge and everything, mm-hmm. and just continue moving forward. So, you know, I think it's definitely been a lot of game here.
Yeah, man, definitely. So that's my goal. You know, as I figure things out, I'm making sure that I'm pouring that information to other people so that, you know, their learning curve can be, you know, shorter than mine was. And, you know, we have to just build this momentum, turn this, you know, this snowball into an avalanche of opportunity and success for, you know, people that look like us. So
definitely. Is there anything else you want to leave with the listeners?
Yeah, I would say, man, if you want to get in contact with me, learnfromchris.com. I have a blog there where I give a lot of great information. You can also join my membership portal through there. It's for people that are just getting started in real estate or maybe want to elevate. If you want to just get into fixing and flipping or if you want to elevate to new construction. Since I didn't have enough time to really segment out hours to mentor people individually, I set up this membership portal. It's kind of like a living library of information of everything that I'm doing. And that'll, you know, help you get to the next level. Also on my Instagram page and my link in my bio, I have a couple of free eBooks. One is for people that have money but don't have time but want to get into real estate. Another one is for the people that have time but don't have the money and want to get into real estate. So y'all can check those out. Those are completely free. Just me helping everybody get their foot in the door of how to get started as real estate investors.
Can you drop your Instagram page too? I have it in the show notes, but I want to make sure it's on the audio too.
Yeah, so it's underscore INVSTR. INVSTR, like investor with most of the vowels missing. Or you can just type in my name, Chris Senegal, and then I'll pull up my Instagram as well.
Definitely, definitely, man. Appreciate you. Appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, no problem, man. I appreciate the invite.
Definitely, definitely. Well, thank you all for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. If you want to stay up to date on what we have going on, text BRED to 21,000. If you'd like to support us as a patron, go to patreon.com/Black Real Estate Dialogue. Look forward to hearing from you all soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue and on Twitter at Bred Podcast. That's BRED Podcast. Until next time. Podcast listeners, what's up? If you've reached the end of the show, thanks so much for listening. We value your time, and that's why we want to give you the best sounding, best produced quality of content we possibly can. And this podcast you've been listening to has been edited and produced by yours truly. I'm Donald the Voice. I'm a 10-year voiceover artist, narrator, and production specialist that wants to see only the best, life-giving, equipping, and long-lasting content be produced to help others. So if you have commercial, video editing, or other production needs, I'd love to talk with you. That's right. Visit DonaldTheVoice.com and hit the contact page to talk about how we can work together to bring your content to life. Okay, so you're not an email person. Well, you can also contact me on Instagram at DonaldTheVoice or on Facebook.com/Donald.TheVoice. I'm looking forward to talking to you.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.